Look, it's Monday, May 4th. The global supply chain is staring down a barrel as the Strait of Hormuz remains a no-go zone, and back home, the White House is sitting on a peace proposal from Iran that might, just might, offer an exit ramp. Meanwhile, OpenAI is bleeding cash while Anthropic plays the adult in the room. And if you're heading into a work week feeling like your brain is a browser with too many tabs open, there's a biological reason for that. Here's what's actually happening. One of the podcasts we're tracking this week ran a geopolitical war game scenario that feels uncomfortably plausible. In this projection, the United States and Israel enter a full-scale war in Iran, and the economic fallout hits the global supply chain with a sledgehammer. The headline in this scenario is the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Because that narrow waterway becomes a no-go zone, we see a massive global commodity shock. Directly, this hits the travel and transport sectors first. In this simulation, airlines slash thousands of flights because jet fuel prices double overnight. It's an operational crisis for the industry. The automotive sector looks at a projected $5 billion hit. When oil shipments stall, you don't just lose gasoline, you lose the supply of aluminum, plastics, and paint required to actually build cars. In the agricultural world, fertilizer prices double. We'd see companies like Emirati Fertiglobe abandon sea routes entirely, choosing to move products by truck, which is expensive and slow, just to keep the gears turning. Now, in this hypothetical, OPEC Plus agrees to a modest production increase, but frankly it's a drop in the bucket. It doesn't solve the physical reality of the strait being closed. Stateside, the projected situation is particularly grim. U.S. oil majors like ExxonMobil and Chevron stick to capital discipline. They prioritize their balance sheets and refuse to rapidly scale up fracking operations, noting that it's too difficult and expensive to do on a dime. Because of that, the U.S. sees the sharpest fuel price shock in the entire G7. Projections show global oil inventories drying up, leading to a June tipping point where shortages force some countries to go without. It's the kind of situation where you'd hope for a clear diplomatic exit ramp. But the signals out of Washington and Tehran in this scenario are messy. According to the report, there's a total stalemate. President Trump's approach oscillates between aggressive threats and offers of engagement. And since there's no direct line of communication, everything is filtered through intermediaries like Pakistan and Oman. However, there is a small crack of light in the simulation. Iran submits a new peace proposal. Crucially, they drop their previous demand that the U.S. lift its naval blockade before talks begin. They suggest a 30-day negotiation window to end the war permanently. The proposal sits with the White House. The move here, if anyone wants to take it, would be a secret talks-about-talks strategy, similar to how the North Korea or JCPOA deal started. But as of right now, the Iranians are wary of a surprise attack during any overture, so they're waiting for a framework before they even agree to meet. While the war rages in this scenario, the situation inside Iran becomes an informational black hole. The Iranian regime imposes a pervasive internet blackout on its own citizens. This isn't just about stopping people from tweeting. For families with relatives in Iran, like Shirin Jafari, it's a total rupture of daily life. Communication is just gone. According to reports, the IRGC conducts phone searches at checkpoints, forcing citizens to meticulously delete their digital lives just to walk down the street. The regime also moves toward a tiered internet system, something they're calling Internet Pro. It requires personal ID and state-approved data access. Basically, they are turning the internet from a public right into a state-controlled privilege. It's a chilling evolution of state power. They've effectively silenced the populace while the war continues, ensuring that the human cost of the conflict stays hidden from the global stage. Back at home, the domestic political landscape is getting increasingly litigious. One of the more speculative stories circulating involves the legal status of former FBI Director James Comey. There are claims floating around about potential indictments, supposedly linked to an Instagram post. Critics are calling this a clear case of selective prosecution, using the legal system to settle personal vendettas while ignoring larger issues like the Epstein files. Look, if this actually moves forward, it's a bit weird, It feels less like a legal maneuver and more like a performance for an audience of one. At the same time, we're seeing a pattern of media intimidation. Donald Trump and his supporters have been harassing Jimmy Kimmel, following a joke the late-night host made. Usually the networks fold, but this time ABC refused to fire him. It's a small sign, but it suggests the mainstream media might finally be reaching a point of Trump fatigue. Then there's the ongoing legal battle over the Voting Rights Act. Critics are warning that recent judicial trends are moving to effectively gut the act by greenlighting partisan gerrymandering. The argument being made by observers is that this essentially silences minority voters and moves the U.S. toward a dead democracy, where the winners are picked by mapmakers rather than the people at the ballot box. And it's not just the courts. The White House is currently being accused of obstructing the Technical Guidelines Development Committee. That sounds like a boring bureaucratic mouthful, but it's the body that sets the security standards for voting machines. The administration has been blocking new appointees to this committee for months, including representatives from the U.S. Access Board, who advocate for voters with disabilities. This is unprecedented in the committee's 20-year history. By paralyzing the people who vet the tech, the administration is making it much more likely that we'll be using outdated, hackable, or inaccessible machines for the midterms. It's a bizarre move for a president who says he's worried about election integrity. He's effectively breaking the very tools designed to ensure it. On the legislative front, Senator Chris Van Hollen is swinging for the fences with a new tax proposal. The bill is a massive restructuring of the federal income tax system. Here's the math. It would eliminate federal income tax entirely for anyone making under $46,000. To pay for that, it hits high earners with a surtax, 5% on income over $1 million, 10% over $2 million, and 12% over $5 million. It's designed to be deficit neutral, but tax experts are pointing out a potential behavioral trade-off. If you concentrate the tax burden on the top 1%, who already pay about 40% of all federal income taxes, you risk those people finding creative ways to stop working or hide their money. There's also the long-term fiscal worry. If you rely on a tiny group of people to fund everything, it gets a lot harder to fix things like Social Security when the math stops adding up. Across the pond, the UK is bracing for what looks like a bloodbath for the Labour Party. Local election results are starting to trickle in, and predictions suggest Labour is headed for its worst performance in England in recent memory, with massive losses in Wales and Scotland as well. Voters are reportedly fed up with the cost of living and healthcare, and Keir Starmer's leadership is taking the heat for it. We're also seeing a fracturing of the two-party system. The Reform Party is picking up voters worried about migration, while the Green Party is eating Labour's lunch by appealing to progressives who are furious over the party's stance on the Gaza conflict. In Australia, the government is dealing with a very different kind of crisis. The Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism has officially started public hearings. This was triggered by the Bondi Beach terror attack and is looking into how hate crimes are impacting social cohesion. One of the big outcomes here is a proposed national gun buyback plan. Several states are already resisting it, so expect a major federal-state showdown over how to actually implement those recommendations. On a lighter, or perhaps just pettier note in the legal world, Yoko Ono is currently suing a French craft beer maker. The crime? They named their beer John Lemon. Ono argues it's a trademark infringement on John Lennon's legacy. It's a reminder that even in the middle of global wars and economic collapse, the intellectual property lawyers are still getting their billable hours in. Finally, a quick look at the wedding arms race. If you feel like every wedding you go to is more expensive than the last, you aren't imagining it. The average wedding in a city like New York has now hit $100,000. Even in the Midwest, couples are dropping $40,000. This is being driven by what experts call a consumer spectacle, fueled by Instagram and Pinterest. It's creating a massive financial burden for young couples, who are basically trying to out-curate each other. Because of that pressure, we're seeing the rise of the micro-wedding, ceremonies with about 30 people. It's a move toward authenticity, but even these aren't cheap. An intimate micro-wedding in D.C. can still run you $30,000. It turns out, even when you cut the guest list, the industry still finds a way to get its cut. So, while the physical world is hitting logistical walls, the digital one is having a bit of a reality check of its own. OpenAI is currently facing a series of significant financial and legal headwinds that are beginning to erode its position as the undisputed leader of the AI sector. According to recent reports, the company has missed key financial targets and is now projected to burn through 14 times more cash than its primary competitor, Anthropic. While OpenAI has scaled back its ambitious spending plans, dropping its 2030 projection from $1.5 trillion to $600 billion, the market is starting to favor the more disciplined approach taken by Anthropic. Anthropic is currently projecting profitability by 2028 and holds a much stronger enterprise revenue base, which now accounts for 80% of its business, compared to OpenAI's 40%. The pressure on OpenAI isn't just coming from the balance sheet. The company is currently defending itself against a lawsuit from Elon Musk, which alleges a breach of its original nonprofit mission and includes a fraud claim regarding his initial $40 million donation. Look, Musk's legal standing on the charitable trust argument is shaky at best, but the fraud claim is a different beast and could actually force a settlement. Beyond the billionaire spat, the company is also facing a lawsuit from victims' families concerning ChatGPT's alleged role in a mass shooting. It's a messy, expensive moment for a company that used to feel untouchable. In the broader market, we're seeing a clear bifurcation in how investors treat AI spending. Big tech earnings show that Google, Apple, and Amazon were rewarded for their growth, while Microsoft and Meta saw their stocks dip. The hit to Meta was particularly sharp because the company is planning massive capital expenditures on AI infrastructure without having a cloud revenue stream to offset those costs. Essentially, the market is tired of vibes and is starting to demand a clear return on investment. Apple is actually winning right now by doing less. They've avoided massive data center investments in favor of share buybacks, and investors seem to love that capital discipline. While the titans fight over infrastructure, the nature of daily work is shifting into what's being called the infinite backlog. The widespread adoption of AI agents, tools that can operate in parallel rather than just assisting a human, means the bottleneck is no longer how fast you can type or code, but how much you can actually manage. This creates a dizziness of freedom, where the theoretical list of what you could do becomes functionally infinite. Honestly, it sounds exhausting. We're moving from a world of execution to a world of constant judgment, coordination, and evaluation. This shift is creating new, highly specific roles like context librarians, coordination architects, and experiment portfolio managers. The core idea is that every job is starting to look like running a tiny startup, where you have unlimited potential output, but very limited time to actually review and approve it. The bottleneck has moved from the hands to the head. For those feeling the fear of becoming obsolete, or FOBO, the current advice is to stop trying to master AI as a broad category. Instead, the focus is shifting toward targeted engagement, picking one specific shitty task in your workflow, and treating the AI as a collaborator rather than a replacement. The goal is to move from learning a tool to solving a problem through conversational interaction. It's a nice sentiment, but it assumes everyone has the mental bandwidth to manage a digital intern while their actual boss is breathing down their neck. There's also a growing skepticism about whether this massive build-out of AI infrastructure is sustainable, or if we're drifting into an industrial bubble. While AI is being used for everything from personalized websites to sophisticated crossword puzzles, the sheer cost of development is staggering. We're seeing a massive divergence between the rapid technological advancement and the actual economic returns. Not for nothing, but if we're building billion-dollar data centers just so we can generate more emails that nobody has time to read, something in the math is eventually going to break. Finally, we're seeing the human cost and social complexity of this rollout start to surface. From concerns about AI psychosis to the ethical mess of using these tools in education, the legal and regulatory landscape is nowhere near caught up. Meta is already mired in legal battles over data privacy and algorithmic bias, and governments are still just scratching the surface of how to regulate AI's influence. We are firmly in the break things phase of move fast and break things, and the fix things phase isn't even on the calendar yet. Speaking of math that eventually breaks, let's talk about the massive transfer of wealth that's about to hit the U.S. economy. The current U.S. estate tax exemption is sitting at roughly $13.6 million per person, or over $27 million for a couple, meaning fewer than 1 in 1,000 estates actually pay it. According to the Prof. G-Pod, this contributes to a system where the government pulls in about $37 billion a year from estate taxes, a figure that looks pretty small against a $36 trillion national debt. The real issue here isn't just the current math. It's the $84 trillion transfer of wealth projected to happen by 2044 as baby boomers and the silent generation pass away. Right now, the wealthiest 1.5% of households are set to account for nearly half of those transfers. The mechanics of this are pretty straightforward. Wealthy individuals can hold assets, let them grow tax-deferred, and borrow against them to live, rather than selling and triggering a capital gains tax. This effectively lets them defer taxes indefinitely. The Prof. G-Pod argues for a more aggressive, progressive structure, specifically dropping the exemption to something like $1 million to reinvest that capital into infrastructure and education. Look, we talk a lot about meritocracy in this country, but it's mostly a fairy tale when you can inherit eight figures tax-free. If you're getting $5 million instead of 10 because of a tax, your life isn't getting worse, but the country's balance sheet might actually start to make sense. It's a shitty system that taxes the person grinding for a paycheck at a higher effective rate than the person who just happened to be born to the right parents. Switching gears to how we actually predict what's coming next, prediction markets like Kalshi and Polymarket are moving into the mainstream. These platforms are now partnering with major media outlets to forecast everything from Fed decisions to election results. The data shows these markets are often more accurate than traditional polling because they rely on the wisdom of crowds to balance out individual biases. Young professionals are being encouraged to use this data as a tool for strategic decision-making, even if they aren't actually betting the money themselves. It's basically the ultimate put-your-money-where-your-mouth-is metric. Polls are full of people lying to themselves or the person on the phone, but the market doesn't care about your feelings. It's dry, it's objective, and honestly, it's probably the only honest data stream we have left in a world of manufactured narratives. Finally, for anyone looking to jump ship on a high-paying job for a passion project, the advice is getting a lot more pragmatic. If you have a family to support or a partner in school, the recommendation is to prioritize financial stability unless you have a concrete offer that mitigates the pay cut. Financial anxiety is a pursuit of happiness killer. Talk to your manager about your goals, but don't blow up your life for a dream you can't afford yet. Being broke isn't a personality trait, it's just stressful. But look, if you're staying in that high-paying job and feeling the grind, it might not just be the workload, it might be your biology. The modern workday is essentially a war on your biology, and the latest research suggests we're losing on three specific fronts: mental bandwidth, emotional regulation, and basic physical circulation. First, the concept of open loops. According to recent productivity research, unfinished tasks, even tiny ones like an unreplied email, occupy significant cognitive bandwidth, leading to chronic anxiety. The fix being reported is a ruthless application of the four D's: delete, delegate, delay, and do. The standout here is delete. It's the most critical step, involving the permanent removal of unnecessary commitments to stop the compounding burden of unfinished business. It turns out doing it all isn't just a myth, it's a cognitive tax we can't afford to pay. On the emotional side, clinical psychologist Jenny Tates is introducing stress resets to move activity from the limbic system to the prefrontal cortex. One technique, Name That Emotion, involves labeling a feeling to reduce its physiological grip. Another, Sing Your Thoughts, suggests singing negative internal monologues to a familiar tune to turn rigid beliefs into malleable noise. It sounds a bit ridiculous, but the goal is cognitive diffusion, distancing yourself from the thought so it stops driving the bus. Finally, journalist Manoush Zomorodi is highlighting the physical toll of what she calls kinked bodies. Prolonged sitting at screens prevents the body from flushing fats and sugars, contributing to high blood pressure and diabetes. Research from physiologist Keith Diaz shows that 5 minutes of movement every 30 minutes can offset this damage. Look, we all know sitting is bad, but the kink description is visceral. We're literally folding our circulatory systems in half and wondering why we have brain fog. It's not a lack of caffeine. It's that your blood is basically stuck in your knees. The recurring theme here is that micro-interventions, a 5-minute walk, or singing a shitty thought, are more effective than waiting for a vacation that never comes. All right, let's pivot to something that matters way more than your health, your FPL rank. Fantasy Premier League managers are heading into Game Week 36, facing a massive structural shift. The big news is a heavy pivot toward Arsenal and Crystal Palace, who both have double game weeks. According to recent analysis, this means it's time to seriously consider offloading players like Cole Palmer and Dominic Calvert-Lewin, whose recent output just hasn't kept pace with the potential upside of these double fixtures. Arsenal is the primary target here. The focus is on Bukayo Saka and Kai Havertz, specifically because Arsenal is chasing goal difference in their run-in against defensively weak sides like West Ham and Burnley. But there's a catch. Saka is reportedly facing minute management due to a recent injury and a looming European semi-final. While he's a massive threat, the expectation is that he might be protected during the West Ham game, making Game Week 37 his more likely window for full involvement. Then there's Crystal Palace. While they have the double game week, their situation is complicated by the Europa Conference League. Manager Oliver Glasner has signaled he'll be managing minutes for stars like Ebereki Eze, Michael Olise, and Jean-Philippe Mateta. Honestly, it's a bit of a trap. The analysis suggests Palace's attackers are high-risk punts because of this rotation. If you want into that squad, the safer bets are actually in the back line, with players like Daniel Munoz or Joachim Anderson, though even Anderson was yanked at halftime recently, so nothing is guaranteed. Speaking of the top of the table, Manchester United's recent form has put a massive spotlight on Bruno Fernandes. He's currently leading the league in chance creation, nearly double the next best player, and has been the engine behind United jumping from 44 goals last season to 63 this year. But while Bruno is carrying the offensive load, the United midfield is still a mess. The partnership of Kobbie Mainoo and Casemiro is being flagged for major positional and defensive weaknesses. It's the classic United story. World-class individual brilliance masking a structural disaster. Finally, we saw a glimpse of where priorities lie for Aston Villa. They rotated 8 players in their recent loss to Tottenham, clearly punting the league to focus on their Europa League semi-final. It worked out for Spurs, who looked significantly more cohesive. But it's a warning for FPL managers. Villa assets are becoming total wildcards as Unai Emery prioritizes a trophy over league position. Look, the takeaway for this week is pretty cynical. You have to be aggressive and chase the double game leagues with Arsenal and Palace. But you have to do it knowing that European semifinals are basically the natural enemy of a reliable FPL starting 11. You're essentially betting on which manager is going to screw you over the least. Good luck with that. Before I let you go, a few other things worth knowing before you head out. Elon Musk is pushing a brand of technological sovereignty that basically promises you're more free if you use his private infrastructure. The reality is a bit more of a trap. The more a country or a person integrates into these systems, the more dependent they are on one guy's whims. It's not really independence if you're just swapping a government for a billionaire with a Twitter habit. In Baltimore, the city's vacant housing crisis isn't an accident or a stroke of bad luck. If you overlay a map of today's derelict properties with the redlining maps from 1937, they're almost identical. This is what 80 years of purposeful disinvestment looks like. A policy decision that's still rotting in plain sight. There's an investment firm called WCM that's doing something weirdly human. They hire for character over credentials and practice what they call overtrust. They basically give employees total autonomy before they've even proven they deserve it. It sounds like a recipe for a disaster, but giving people actual ownership seems to work better than the usual corporate micromanagement bullshit. And finally, we're seeing the inevitable hangover from the growth at all costs era. A lot of founders who looked like geniuses during the market boom are hitting a wall now that the money isn't free anymore. It turns out that burning cash to buy market share is a great way to commit financial suicide the second the tide turns. Honestly, it's a hell of a way to learn that math actually matters. Anyway, that's the short list.